Welcome to Talk Dizzy to Me, the show that brings you a comprehensive look into the complex field of dizziness. Now here are your hosts, vestibular physical therapist Dr. Abby Ross and Dr. Danielle Tolman.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Talk Dizzy to Me. I'm Dr. Abby Ross. I'm a vestibular physical therapist and neuroclinical specialist. Joined, as always, you know by now, Dr. Danny Tolman, also a vestibular therapist. And you know, I always love to call on my old colleagues to join us on the episode. One, because I know that they know what they're talking about. And two, because I got my start with some of these colleagues. So it's been so fun to see how I've grown, how they've grown, and how we can help this population of people that desperately need us to get through their vestibular journeys. So today I have an old colleague on. We have an old colleague on. She goes by Dr. Joanna Wolfson, and she's here to talk about one of my absolute favorite topics. Actually, I have a little aside to put in here. Back in the day when I was maybe my first or second year of physical therapy at NYU, where I started my career, they make you do internships. And I remember being so nervous for an internship, and I ended up choosing the topic psychological impacts in vestibular therapy. And here we are today to talk about the same thing. So it's full circle for me. Dr. Joanna Wolfson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. And Abby, definitely good to see you. We miss you a lot at Rusk, but obviously good to see you're doing very important things.
Such fun things. So basically, we're going to get into the relationship between psychological symptoms and impacts and vestibular dysfunction. But first, this is a specialty area for you as well. So can you talk to our audience a little bit about how you got into this position?
Yes, I'm very happy to be in this position, and it's very specialized. It feels very niche. It's nice to say that I feel like it's unique in that not many people necessarily do this in a lot of other healthcare settings. So just briefly, I'm a clinical psychologist by training. So I did my grad degree, which feels like forever ago, at a small school called Fairleigh Dickinson in Teaneck, New Jersey. And so that was sort of basic psychology training, but I always gravitated towards any of my practicums that had to do with health populations, medical populations. I just really always enjoyed that overlap between sort of a puzzle of trying to help people understand where their physical symptoms come from. And we really have learned a lot about just that overlap between true medical issues and conditions and just the ways in which it creates stress and that stress plays back into these syndromes. So I actually did my, speaking of internships, Abby, I did my internship here at NYU Rusk, where I'm currently working. And so it's part of NYU's main hospital system. Rusk is a rehabilitation medicine facility. And we see people throughout the medical center. So not just within the vestibular unit, but also through the cardiopulmonary service and the oncology center and people with all sorts of different chronic health conditions. So I did my training here and then kind of furthered the work in health psychology through a postdoc at the Manhattan VA and then have been back at Rusk. I've loved it here. So I've been back since and I work a lot starting an internship and then continuing on with our service that treats people with vestibular disorders. So I've had the fortune of working alongside people like Abby and Danielle, the vestibular physical therapists, the vestibular neurologists, ENTs, a vision occupational therapist. So I really just love the true interdisciplinary nature of this work. And, you know, it's a very special population that has a great level of need that's often, I think, overlooked or misunderstood by the many people that these patients tend to see.
That's so true. And you bring up a good point that this is strewn throughout our episodes. Pretty much every episode we come up with the topic of multidisciplinary approach. And here you are in another field, but play such an integral role in these patients' lives. You know, we do some what I would call psych care. in the sense that we're teaching relaxation strategies and we, I think, provide coping mechanisms, but certainly we're not the experts. So when it comes to dizziness or vestibular dysfunction in general, what specific psychological impacts do you see most often?
I think there's a lot of them. It's a very wide range. Just through research, you know, we know that if we're thinking about diagnosable comorbid psychological conditions that can happen maybe as a result of having these conditions, upwards of 30 to 50% of people actually deal with a psychological difficulty. And that's when we just talk about true diagnosis. So first, many people that have vestibular conditions often also have anxiety. I'd say that's probably the biggest, one of the biggest consequences of dealing with these really frightening and out of control feeling types of symptoms. So the things that we probably see most are people talking about anxiety, whether that means just sort of worry about their condition and whether they'll ever get better or what it means for their quality of life or their future. Very commonly, panic is something that we do see, and whether that's a full-blown panic attack or not depends on someone's history and what people are dealing with. But there's a lot of question about how much of symptoms are influenced by that process of panic, because we know that anxiety and panic really exacerbate any pre-existing physical symptoms. And many people do experience depression. That's very common. So there's that invisible illness quality to this, where it's really hard for other people, no matter how close the support in one's life, to really understand what this is like for someone going through it. So social isolation is pretty high. People are cut off often from the activities that used to drive them, their previously very active lifestyles because of their symptoms. So it can be sad or a sense of loss, and people do report, even if they've never felt the need for psychological care before, that now they find themselves in that position.
Can you tell me the difference between anxiety and panic?
This is a question that comes up a lot. And so first, I would say anxiety can be an umbrella term that includes panic. But the way that I like to think about it is anxiety is more of kind of the trait of being nervous, anxious, on edge. It might be felt in the body, but it's more people can think about, I'm really worried about something. You know, I really can't kind of get out of my thoughts about what might happen next. Am I going to be safe? There's a lot of things that go along with anxiety, but it's sort of that day-to-day just general worry is the way that I would describe it. Panic is a massive body feeling. So it's basically the fight or flight response that happens suddenly. So people often say, you know, how would I know if I'm having a panic attack? And then when people have had panic attacks, they're like, you can't miss it. You know, there's just no way to mistake the fact that something really bad feeling is happening to my body. So a panic attack often includes a sudden surge of feeling like I can't breathe, my heart is racing, often dizziness and lightheadedness. Some people have things like sweating, temperature changes, and often a sense that I have to get out of wherever I am, a sense of doom, or that I might die even if I don't escape somewhere. So panic is much more, I think, intense and a surge, and it can't last forever. Whereas people might have the sense that I'm just always anxious. I really can't get out of anxiety.
Okay, that makes sense. Something else just came to mind in talking about anxiety. And you may or may not know this, but do you know what percentage of the general population has anxiety?
Yeah. So I would have to honestly look up most current rates. And a lot of these rates are underreported because we sort of know about the people that report this to their doctor or report this to a psychologist. But if we think about, you know, depression and anxiety have a lot of overlap. So usually the rates are anywhere between about 5 and 10, maybe 15%, depending on the population. I also hesitate a bit because anxiety, there are probably about 6 to 7 different types of anxieties that can happen. For some people, it's social anxiety. For some people, it's a phobia. For some people, it's general. And so those rates really vary. But I think there's something like the lifetime rate of having any anxiety disorder is high. It's like a third to two-thirds of people at some point, you know, will suffer from anxiety. So a lot of people might go through it, but we do know that when people have any chronic health condition, and you know, vestibular conditions are one where it really makes sense to be anxious. It would be a little bit strange, I think, if someone felt like they could fall at any moment and not be worried about that or not have a level of hypervigilance to how their body's doing. So anxiety, I know I work in a very specialized setting where we see people because they're anxious, but I've never had someone with a vestibular condition that says, I actually have no anxiety about this.
I wanted to ask a little bit about that because I feel like this tends to be my general patient population working with Dizzy are people who are more predisposed or likely to have increased anxiety. But I will say there are times I come across people that don't have that. And it's almost like their vestibular condition completely goes missed because they aren't bothered by symptoms. Or I can't tell you how many people I've had that have had BBBV and they don't even describe room spinning dizziness. They just feel fuzzy, even though their eyeballs look like they're rolling out of their head. So a part of me wonders deep down how much of the general population are we missing vestibular dysfunction in because they're not bothered by symptoms? And are we generalizing the idea that people with higher anxiety are more likely to have vestibular dysfunction just because they are reporting to the clinic? These are the ones that are bothered by their symptoms. They're bothered by ongoing, residual symptoms, and they're more likely to seek care and wait for care versus somebody who maybe went through a short bout of something and didn't want to wait 4 weeks to get into their doctor. But it's so chicken or the egg, right? I think it's hard to kind of pin that down when we look at it from that point of view.
Right. That's actually a really good question. I've never really thought about that specific question before. But I think about in psychology, we have a way where we classify once something is called a disorder for someone, which is a little bit different than we probably classify medical conditions. But, you know, in psychology, people can be anxious without having an anxiety disorder. And it's called a disorder once it either interferes with their life to the point where they really can't function in some way, or they're very distressed by their symptoms. So I would agree in saying that my guess is probably more people suffer from or deal with vestibular symptoms than anyone ever knows or sees. And I guess my question would be, you know, would we then still call someone as having a vestibular disorder, or is it that everyone has a degree of disequilibrium, or, you know, the body for anyone is never in perfect equilibrium and different things trigger that. And some people maybe are okay with that or like don't really feel too frazzled by it or expect it will pass. And I think one of the things that often happens, especially when we think about that PPPD, and you guys are going to have to help me with what that stands for, because I always mix up the acronym. But, you know, one of the things in the literature that we know can make or break part of the recovery is if people have the expectation that some level of symptoms might just be sort of my normal and that's okay. And just because I have symptoms doesn't mean that I can't live my life or that this is horrible. The people that expect I never have a single symptom again are actually the ones that don't do as well with ongoing symptoms.
Yeah, and 3PD stands for persistent postural perceptual dizziness for anyone who has not heard of that term or maybe was wondering what it stood for. Danny, were you going to add something there?
I was just going to say that couldn't be more put a better way. I mean, that couldn't be better explained. And I think that was a really, really excellent point that mindset can be everything. And it's not about accepting that, you know, you're never going to get better. That's not the view. It's not a half empty. It's that you are able to become functional again and regain some of normalcy in life, whether it's, you know, maybe not completely symptom-free, you can still function and manage. And I think that helping patients get to that point is really, really important for care. I think you're absolutely right. My patients that constantly want that 2% improvement seem to constantly be chasing that something, and they're constantly making themselves a little bit more stressed about that recovery. So that's a really great point.
You know, when you first meet a patient, I think that is the conversation that is so important to have right from the beginning, is setting expectations and what you can expect through therapy and what you can expect by the time discharge comes. And you might not be 100% better every single day for the rest of your life, but you will have tools, you will have resources, you will have coping strategies, you will have a better understanding and knowledge about what you're dealing with and why you're dealing with it. And then the other thing I wanted to mention was, this has happened with both of my parents, where they'll have a night of what I think is most likely BPPV. They'll be like, I woke up to go to the bathroom and my whole world was spinning, but I woke up this morning and it's fine. And so even in those cases, I bet 100% of the population at some point has something vestibular happen. It's just not everyone needs care to get it better. That's what I think. So we know that vestibular symptoms and the way that they impact our lives literally can change our lives. And by that, I mean, they can change the relationships we have with not only others, but with ourselves. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So I think this concept of self-esteem is certainly one, but just the concept of identity and people feeling like they can really put their faith in knowing who they've been, who they are today, and what to expect for themselves for the future. So when we're talking about any vestibular condition that has really literally turned people's worlds upside down and kind of rocked their sense of, can I trust myself? Can I rely on my physical abilities? Once that is unclear to them, it often has this ripple effect of, do I have confidence in any part of myself? Can I trust my thinking? Can I trust the fact that I used to not be anxious and now I am? Can I trust? I think that kind of pairs with this difficulty sometimes trusting the medical world, who doesn't always have answers for them. So I think identity comes up a lot. It's really hard for people to feel like, I used to never think about who I was or what I was capable of, and now I think about it all the time. Many people's, you know, most common grounding and coping exercises are taken away, and we've worked with people anywhere from like professional athletes to people who worked really high profile jobs, and even people who used to say, I just used to walk my dog every day and never think about it. Now that the act of having to think about these things all the time can really change people's confidence, and for most people, you know, it doesn't only impact how they feel about themselves, but it then plays into their relationships with others, how confident they feel in relationships with others. And then they're kind of getting back from others this sense that, you know, how close of a support is someone who I thought of as a rock before? I think it's really hard for anyone, even medical providers in someone's life, no one can get inside someone else's body and just get what this is like to walk around feeling dizzy or feeling imbalanced. So it can be pretty disconcerting to people to have this experience of really feeling alone, both not knowing who I am and then feeling like I don't really know if other people can truly see or understand me or get me, which is just such an important part about human connection.
Yeah, the invisibility of the symptoms and just everything that goes along with vestibular dysfunction can certainly feed into that even more. So I'm glad you brought that up. When it comes to, let's say I'm a patient and I'm in your office for the first time and I'm telling you my story and some of these concerns are coming up, I'm feeling anxious, I can't stop these ruminating thoughts about whether or not I feel safe, do I trust myself, my relationships have changed not only with myself but with others, where are you starting in that, and what kind of tips and strategies do you offer patients?
Yeah. So that's a really good and broad question. And I want to think about just sort of in general, I think first people are very overwhelmed by the time they come to psychology. And ideally psychology, by the way, would not be a last stop. It would be nicely woven into the first stop of this, because we really can't separate the mind-body experience. And we just know that the more kind of coordinated providers exist off the bat, the more, you know, comforted and I think coordinated everything feels and is for someone. But usually by the time people come and they share everything you just mentioned, Abby, they don't know where to start. They're very overwhelmed. And it feels like, you know, I am so far from feeling normal. I'm so far from feeling in control that people can't possibly imagine sometimes things getting better. So I think the first thing is really just validating for them that all the things they're feeling make a lot of sense given what they've gone through. And that many other people with vestibular conditions say the exact same thing. Many people have not met other people with vestibular conditions. It's a weird, well-kept secret, seemingly. I feel fortunate that where I work, we run a stress management group, and it's a supportive in nature, but it does bring people together who can kind of finally feel like, oh my gosh, I found someone else going through the very same thing. But I think the first part is just validating that having anxiety here actually makes a lot of sense. Feeling alone is something that you're not alone in feeling. Many other people report the same thing. And many just want to sort of tell their story, have it be heard and understood. And I think that's kind of the first step. I think for me, what seems to give people the most relief off the bat is any form of psychoeducation, any form of really understanding anything they can know about specifically the overlap between like, where did my symptoms come from and how are they maintained by things like the stress that it's causing. So I'm not a medical doctor. I often say, I wish we all, no matter who it is, had a better MRI into the body that almost takes a history and is like, okay, you know, I'd say a common theme is something like, I think I was sick for a few weeks and then I took an airplane ride and then, you know, my grandmother passed away and there was a really high stressful period at work and it all gets really muddled together. And someone, for reasons we can't quite understand the full picture or etiology, they wake up one day and the room is spinning. And many people first want to know why did this happen? And if I could figure out why it's happening, then there's an answer. And I think where people feel very stymied and demoralized is when they've been to provider after provider and no one can really answer that question for them. And they haven't yet found that silver bullet that just like undoes that process. So I think kind of just first telling people that is really a traumatic experience to go through all that and to not know what the future holds. But usually for people, the specific explanation that it's happened for some reason, that's probably verified. There is a sensitivity in the vestibular system in the inner ear. You had a lot of possible triggers. And that at that point, the brief thing I go through is how there's then an adaptive response at first where the brain is on hypervigilance. It's trying to help people be safe and not fall and maintain sense of their world. So the brain is hypervigilant. The body changes. The body braces and maybe posture changes and people look at the floor. And there's all sorts of things that people do that initially are helpful to stay safe. But once they enter into a cycle where that's what they do more of the time, it's now not adaptive anymore. And at that point in the brain, the vestibular system kind of takes a back seat because it's like, oh, you don't need me anymore. You know, you're so vigilant. Your eyes are taking over the work that it almost feels like I can't trust myself. It's an out-of-body experience. And if we can tame the part that has more to do with that hypervigilance and the fight or flight mechanism, we can kind of bring the body back down. And that's the work we want to do in psychology. So I think just the explanation, trying to start very small. Danielle, you were saying earlier about people may want to know, I'll never have symptoms again. And so I never want to say to someone, you're going to have symptoms for the rest of your life, because that may not be true. But just that we don't have to make our goal be perfect score. You know, we just have to make our goal be something that we might call it, we work with SMART goals. I'm sure, Abby, you remember this from Russ, but it's how do we have like a really clear, measurable, time-bound goal where we know something's happening. And that might just look something like, if I've been avoiding, you know, walking more than a block, It might mean that one goal is just knowing I've walked a block and a step. You know, another goal is that I've avoided telling my friends what's going on. Maybe I create a script to tell one person what's happening. Just kind of getting them to reconnect in any way, build up a little bit more of what they remember about who they were so that their identity is not so kind of out of reach for them. And then doing anything like a relaxation exercise to calm the body, looking at a thought that maybe is maladaptive and trying to balance it in a more realistic way. So starting really small, I usually tell people because whether it's through the vestibular service or otherwise, anxiety is very treatable, which is why I love the work that I do. It's evidence-based treatment for anxiety works really well. I've almost never seen it not work. So I usually like to say to people that like this will work to some degree. And I think they need to hear something like that. And that it doesn't mean that I think they will have no vestibular symptoms anymore, but that there's this clear for anyone part of the anxiety response that is just making this all worse or keeping it going longer than it needs to. And so that's the part that I know we can work on that almost always works. And I don't know what the future holds, but that they're likely going to walk out of this whole experience with a coordinated team feeling better than they feel in this moment.
I think it's important too to point out that a lot of patients get very anxious when they can't put a term or a diagnosis on what's going on. And I frequently hear, I wish this was something that was like cancer and we can just treat it and be done with it. Like, how terrible do people feel that they wish they'd rather have cancer than a vestibular dysfunction? But it's something we hear often. And I think you're absolutely right. The patient education, validating their feelings, making them feel that this isn't just made up in their head, that what they're feeling is physiologically happening and real is a huge first step. And then also just kind of saying, as we try to figure this out, let's go along these strategies to help decrease these symptoms until you can reach your diagnosis, until they figure out what's going on. And sometimes being okay with the fact that you don't need a label, you don't need a diagnosis to start your journey in recovery. I think you're absolutely right. That's huge. That's like that great first step that takes that big weight off of people's shoulders.
Right. And I think I also think of something you said, Danielle, almost this metaphor of like we need to kind of like clear up the fluff. So we can't really almost get to the bottom of what's left over. If anxiety is so high that it's causing 17 symptoms in and of itself. So kind of like the work of psychology is just let's get sort of the anxiety and the fight or flight and the panic cleared away as much as we can. This sometimes, by the way, and not uncommonly, I do feel extends to other stressors in people's lives that have nothing to do with their vestibular condition. So sometimes we sort of deal with the fear of the symptoms and start there, but then people sort of bring in, you know, I'm thinking about the larger picture, and I've really had this boss who's very hard to deal with for 7 years now, and I'm wondering if some of the stress of work is just keeping my body, you know, in this heightened state. Or even people will say, I've never really been good at setting boundaries or saying no. And it's just interesting what comes in and how wide the range is of what can kind of be worked on to just help the body actually feel safer and more secure, because we know any stress goes to the body first. For some people, it just seems like vestibular symptoms are the more vulnerable spot, especially if there has been something like BPPV or something else kind of triggering that very precarious system.
Absolutely. I love something you said in this episode. We'll probably pull it out and post just this because I think it's so profound. But you said anxiety is a treatable condition. And I don't think everyone, including myself, really understands or maybe believes that. But to know there's something that you can do to help anxiety, I think is huge. And I'm so glad we have you on the show to tell us this. So along those lines, there are certain aspects that may be anxiety related that people that carries over into their everyday life. And one of those things might be their ability to participate out in the community. So can you talk to us a little bit about strategies that you guide someone in to reintegrate into community?
Yeah, so when anxiety is a big part of the picture of that, so when people are avoiding things because, you know, I think people bring in a couple different reasons for this. And one is just the fear of having symptoms when I'm out, and maybe the catastrophic thought that something really bad will happen to me. That bad thing might be I'm not safe, I get hurt, I'm by myself, I suffer. Other people might just feel embarrassed and feel like, I don't want to be in a crowd and have an episode or need help, or I don't want people in my life to see me like this. So there's a lot of thoughts that go into people's worlds that end up kind of getting smaller and smaller. So one technique that's very simple that I really like is just working with people to create something called a hierarchy of feared events. This is one more like CBT, behavioral therapy oriented strategy. And what it looks like is really almost creating a scale of 0 to 100, 0 being something that doesn't bother me at all. So maybe stepping out into my stoop, not scary. Where 100 would be I'm in a wide open concert space in a crowd with loud noises and, you know, bright lights. And then just having people anchor what's at their 50, what's their 25, what's their 75, and kind of understanding that the goal is to slowly work their way up. It doesn't mean they have to do the thing at the 100. But if anxiety is really driving this process, I like to really be very nitty gritty and scientific about it and think about what is something you can do just this week that would be doable. You know you can do it, you know you will do it, but it is slightly challenging. And it's okay. People have asked me, actually, I had one person ask a really good question in a group that was like, is it better if I need to rely on a friend as a crutch? Is it better to go out with that friend and do, let's say, an errand? Or should I just stay home and not do it at all because the crutch is kind of like cheating? And the answer is do it with the crutch. Getting out and doing something is always better than staying home and not. And this is how exposure works for people, especially when safety is a concern. When I do this, by the way, I almost always talk first with the person's vestibular physical therapist, because sometimes people do have a fall risk. I don't want to tell people to do things that aren't safe. So if anyone, you know, has a condition where they're not sure about safety, before you do something like this, chat with your doctor, chat with your therapist. But more often than not, most of the people that I work with who haven't necessarily had a bad fall or are really not at a fall risk, their therapist says there's nothing they can't, you know, there's nothing they need to avoid. And these hierarchies can also apply to something very specific. Like I've used this a lot with driving, people who have a fear of getting back to driving. And so just with driving, there can be a hierarchy of anything like sitting in my car in my driveway, to just pulling around the corner, to driving on a local road, etc. So that's one specific answer, I think, to this question about community reintegration with anxiety.
That whole hierarchy that you just spoke about, every time we have an episode that has to do with psychological impacts, I always think, man, this can apply to just everyday life too. I mean, any sort of stressor or thing that taps into your discomfort a little bit, you could put on this scale and really show yourself and prove to yourself and then trust yourself that you can accomplish those things. I love that one. What about specific to hypervigilance? So we talked about how hypervigilance is a normal thing. I mean, it's a normal response. We expect this. Your body and mind are experiencing something abnormal, so you should be hypervigilant. But how do we control that a little bit better?
Yeah. So that is a question I get a lot. And it's hard to turn it off because it's actually an evolutionary mechanism that we need. We need to be hypervigilant if we feel unsafe. So the first thing is, again, just explaining what it is and explaining it as a fight or flight mechanism where things really happen to the body. So vision, your pupils dilate. So your pupils dilate to be able to see what it needs to see and let in more light. And that's part of the reason for light sensitivity for some people. You know, in that state of hypervigilance too, thoughts can race because if people do need to detect a threat and get out of there, then the brain's trying to process really quickly, what's safe, where can I go, what can I do? But it might take the form of any racing thoughts. So I show a diagram of the fight or flight response and show what hypervigilance looks like on paper. And people then can also understand, okay, some of these symptoms overlap with my vestibular symptoms. So when I enter, let's say, into a supermarket, there may be a part that's really triggering for the vestibular system, but there's also that hypervigilance piece where you're just kind of on alert, overwhelmed, and sort of in a state of panic. So part of it is just being able to say to yourself, right? If you walk in somewhere and start to be symptomatic, just say something like, there's my hypervigilance again, and have a really neutral way of talking about it that kind of de-emphasizes the hypervigilance, right? Some of these symptoms are par for the course because my brain is trying to protect me. And so it's really going to make me a little bit visually overwhelmed or even a little lightheaded because my body's trying to hang on to oxygen that I might need to run. I don't need to run. I've been here before, right? I can let my guard down a little bit. So it starts with the understanding of what it is, and then trying to kind of have a neutral way of responding. The other technique I really love, which I'll share briefly, is called a 5-4-3-2-1 grounding exercise. I know some of the vestibular PTs here use it. And it's a way to just kind of bring yourself back down to earth. So this is for anyone who finds themselves almost that feeling of depersonalization, or I'm floating outside my body, or oh gosh, this is scary. And all it is just finding five things that you can see and just really noticing. I see my cup, the lamp, the phone, and labeling it. Then touching four different objects, right? So if you're out, okay, touching the tree, I feel my feet on the ground, touching the mailbox. So four things you can feel, and then three things you can hear. By the time people get to three things they can hear, it's kind of like, you know, the body and the senses are engaged, where it's almost forgetting about the hypervigilance in a way. So three things you can hear, two things that you can smell, and then one thing you can taste. So, you know, people have permission to get up and like wander their environment or room to find what they need. But it is a way to just take that body activation and really bring it down a notch and kind of bring people back down to earth.
Sounds like it's bringing awareness. We just spent an episode talking to a clinician about bringing awareness to a lot of this and helping with relaxation techniques, and it sounds very similar, being aware of your hypervigilance and not panicking at the hypervigilance, being, oh, this is happening, this is normal, and just kind of talking yourself down from that. I love that. I think that's a really good strategy and a really good technique to use.
We also talked about being able to choose where you bring your attention to. And I thought that is classic, because I always think distraction is what's helping people, but she corrected me and she said it's not distraction, it's you choosing to bring your attention to something else. And that's what the 5-4-3-2-1 grounding exercise really does. Now, generally speaking, relaxation techniques, what are your go-tos?
Yeah, so I think of something quick and easy, and that can be done anywhere. So I think people have this idea that they really have to be in a dark, quiet room and have 15 to 20 minutes to meditate and clear their mind. And I cannot do that. So I've never had personal luck with that one. But one that people may have heard of is what we call here a square breathing technique, or boxed breathing. You guys may have shared it in the past, but I like it because it's really easy. It's just breathing in for four counts, holding your breath for four counts, exhaling for four counts, pausing maybe for four counts, and then just doing that four times. So the whole point of the breathing is it's the exact opposite of fight or flight. So fight or flight brings every part of the body, the heart, the breathing, you know, into sort of distress in a way. And then breathing, it's like you're directly impacting that system. If you get your breathing under control, everything else follows. So ideally, people are doing this before they enter the panic state. People might report, you know, once I'm in that 10 out of 10 stress scale and my symptoms are flaring up, it's really hard to have this work very well, which is why doing these types of exercises, even when calm, a couple times a day, no matter what, before I leave home, before I enter into a potentially anxiety-provoking situation, that's the best time to use these, because you're wanting to get your level down before you have the chance to be somewhere where panic is like already hanging on a thread. So that's a go-to. The other one I really like is a progressive muscle relaxation exercise. And similarly, just as we talked about, you know, breathing gets shallow when people are anxious. The first thing people do is hold their breath when they're scared. muscles also tense, especially when people feel out of control of their bodies. That's the most common thing that people will do. So the progressive muscle relaxation is an exercise of just like tensing and then releasing different muscle groups. And part of the reason for doing this is raising awareness, again, that word of when do my muscles feel tight and what does that feel like? And then what is it like to release them? So many of us walk around, I'm guilty of it too. And at the end of the day, I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, my shoulders, what have I been doing all day? We don't even realize that we're just holding this tension. And then it can lead to headache or, you know, other problems. So the more people practice these things, the more common it feels. I used to actually not really do breathing. And then once I was in this field, I was like, I better take my own medicine and start to do this. And I've noticed actually that even though I was also a little bit, you know, how much is this going to work? Unsure. But what I at least notice now is that when I hold my breath because I'm, let's say, working on something or I'm distracted, I'm kind of stressed, I notice it pretty quickly. So that is what it has done for me, is just help me recognize pretty quickly, oh my gosh, okay, I'm tensing again, or I'm holding my breath. So practicing these things doesn't mean we're never going to have moments of stress that go to the body. We all will all the time for the rest of our lives, but we want to do what happens next is the most important thing.
You will be very happy to know that in our episodes now, we have a moment where we ask our audience to take a nice deep breath.
Love it.
Okay. I'm not saying it's for them. It's more for us. But now let's talk about what happens in the midst of an attack. We think about our anxiety and our worry about, will this happen again? When will it happen again? But also, when it's happening, what do we do for ourselves to improve the moment?
So this is one thing I really like when people ask this question in therapy and bring this this fear up. One, because it's a realistic fear, and that's people's worst fear, is like, what if this happens again? So I really like to think about this in advance and talk through, okay, like, let's say it happens again, what would you do? And the first thing is that people often find, once it's happened once, they have a little bit more knowledge about what to expect. And then they can draw on, you know, history. So for some people, they're like, it felt so horrible. It was the worst thing, but I'm not still feeling that way. You know, it didn't last forever. I didn't end up in the hospital. I didn't get hit by a car, you know. So sort of just the reminder that it feels really awful. That is the bad part. You don't want to feel this way. Most of the time, people are still safe. And so the hope is that people can kind of prepare ahead so they notice warning signs of symptoms that might lead to full-blown episodes. But sometimes people can't predict and some things happen, or people have a loose crystal and they find themselves in that state. So the first thing is, again, sort of that reminder that, okay, this really, really doesn't feel good. It's always abated. It's always passed. And what I can do is whatever helps people feel the safest and most comfortable in an episode, I'd say do that. So if for you lying in a dark room helps, do that. No harm, no foul. Just do whatever it takes to kind of minimize the chance of more distress, minimize the chance of feeling unsafe. But I think in the process, don't make any judgments about what this means for you while it's happening. So while you're in the middle of it, you're already down, don't kick yourself again. You know, don't say something to yourself like, I'm you know, handling this horribly, or why can't I figure this out by now? Or this means my symptoms will never be better. That is what the brain wants to do. But it is, first of all, we don't know if any of those things are true. And sometimes this is, unfortunately, depending on what people are dealing with, for any of us, just the nature of the beast of our bodies. Sometimes we have things that do trigger symptoms. And that doesn't mean that, you know, we're doomed to a life of episodes, but just that, oh, it happens to be happening now. I wish it wasn't. But I'm just going to do whatever I can to give myself a break, you know, be as safe as I can, take a breath if I can, and just kind of like, just wait, right? Just ride it out and wait until this is over.
So good. I can't wait for this episode to come out. Moving forward, we've touched on this topic before about the feeling of isolation and how your symptoms can impact relationships, not only with others, but also with yourself. You also spoke about a stress management group that brings people together where you learn that you're not alone. For those people that maybe don't have that benefit, they're not in New York City, what recommendations do you have for them?
I think if people are in therapy of any kind, you know, physical therapy, meeting with their doctors, psychotherapy, I really like to encourage people to bring a family member or friend with them to an appointment, just so that people can really hear, not have the burden be on the patient to explain it all, because it'll fall short. You know, there's just no way someone else is going to be able to fully understand what this feels like. When people attend a doctor's appointment, they're hearing it from an authority figure, a professional, or someone who's seen, you know, thousands of people dealing with this and can maybe explain it a little bit more scientifically. And so the first thing is that I think people also feel less alone when someone is a support and accompanying them to an appointment, and they don't have to be the ones, again, to bear the burden of explaining this. So I think, you know, that's one thing I recommend. Sometimes what people do, I know you guys too, we love the Vestibular Disorders Association, the VIDA website, very kind of clear materials and information. So sometimes we encourage people to, you know, direct people there, or just print something out. Hey, this is something that's really clear. It helped me understand some of the impact of, you know, this on my mood or on my anxiety. It's a page. Check it out. Let me know what you think. And sometimes I think, you know, just not feeling pressure to have someone understand this completely, because it might then feel like support is really, really low. If I have to have someone understand it completely, then support is really, really low. But sometimes just saying to someone, you know, I just want to share where I am in my journey and how I feel. And all you have to do is listen. You don't have to solve. You don't have to problem solve. But I'm just giving you a call. I'm going to share for about 5 minutes. And kind of giving the other person permission to just be on the line. Just listen and not have to say anything about what the person should do, because likely the patient has already tried it.
Absolutely. And along those lines, then, you're talking about in relation with others. What about in relation to yourself? Let's say you're feeling like you're just not yourself anymore. You're a shell of yourself. What things can you do to bring yourself back to yourself?
Sometimes it's really, really going back to the basics and just sort of simple rules. Like every day I will get up and shower and put my clothes on. You know, maybe it's, if I've always felt better wearing lipstick, I'm going to just do that. If it's, you know, I can't imagine meeting my friends for dinner like I used to, it's okay. What modification of this, even if it feels really, really small and so different from before, but what can I do that's sort of a step in that direction? And maybe it's, you know, I call a friend while I'm home, you know, we FaceTime and we have like a coffee together, whatever it might be. So just kind of finding ways of not having it be all or nothing, not I have to get back to my life as I knew it, and myself as I knew it, but what are things that just approximate who I used to be and what I used to enjoy? Sort of this principle of behavioral activation, that once people start to get back to things, usually there is a domino effect where people feel a little bit better, and then it prompts the next thing and people feel a little bit better than that and they want to do more. So that's usually the way in.
Do you ever have an instance where this journey that patients go on come out on a different side than when they came in? For example, do they find a different way to find purpose or meaning? Do they change their career hobbies? Do they change their support system? And how does that look when they do come out on the other side? Is it for the better? Do they seem to benefit from that? What does that look like?
Yeah, and I guess it can be its own topic, but there's something, it's a term that kind of gets thrown around, but called post-traumatic growth that gets thrown around the psychology world. And it's kind of this concept that when we've been through something that feels really traumatic or challenging or hard, while we never wanted to go through that, sometimes it does create a level of personal growth that maybe wouldn't have been achieved had we not felt so vulnerable or really reevaluated our values here. And so I do see a lot of meaning making where people think about, I have to pace myself a lot more than before. And actually, looking back, maybe the way that I just pushed through adversity and stress and let people kind of dictate, my life more than I would have liked wasn't the best way to be operating. And it does kind of, I think, make people check themselves a bit, especially in terms of self-care. Self-care, pacing, boundaries. So I have seen people who maybe do make a little bit of a different choice if they're going back to work. I'm really going to make sure that I'm not in a position where the people I work with create levels of demands that just don't work for me. Or before I return to work, I'm going to set up my whole system in advance to make sure I prioritize all of my appointments or my family life. So I have seen this, and this extends to people kind of across, the medical center with any condition they've been navigating that has really just thrown a monkey wrench into their kind of whole way of operating.
What would you say? I feel like that is leading me to this mic drop moment where it's like life is for living. And sometimes we have these experiences that they teach us, like, life is for living. You know what I mean? What would be your mic drop moment or your parting words for our audience on this topic?
It's a really I have to think about that one, but I think kind of like consider your values might be one. People sort of like blow through life a lot of the time and don't always stop to think, am I living in line with my values? So if people were to rank order their values, what would you put first? Would you put your health, your job, your family, money, enjoyment, my mood? All those things sound important, but I think, people kind of get caught up in whatever the life is that they're living and don't really stop to think, is this working well for me? So I think just sort of like taking time to think about what would my priority list be, what would my values list look like, and how close am I to living in line with that? If my first value is my happiness or my mood, am I is that what my life looks like? Is it set up in that way? And if not, just small, right? Like, what's one small thing I can shift that brings myself a little closer to that value? That would be my maybe parting thoughts here.
Amazing. Dr. Wolfson, thank you so much for coming on the show. I thoroughly enjoyed this episode for myself. I'm sure our audience is going to enjoy this too. And we just might have to have you back because this was good.
Well, thank you for having me. This has been my pleasure. It's really fun to talk to you guys. I'm surprised how fast time flew, actually. And I would welcome coming back anytime. So thank you for inviting me today.
Thank you all for joining us. Until next time.
This podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition.
The content of this podcast is based on general knowledge and information available up until the recording of this specific episode. Medical knowledge and practices may evolve over time, and new information may emerge that could change the understanding or treatment of vestibular dysfunction. It is important to consult a qualified healthcare professional for the most up-to-date and personalized advice.
The information provided in this podcast is meant to complement, not replace, the relationship that exists between a patient and their healthcare provider. It is intended to empower patients with knowledge about vestibular dysfunction and its management, but individual cases may vary and treatment approaches should be tailored to each patient's unique circumstances.
By listening to this podcast, you acknowledge and agree to the terms of this medical disclaimer. The organizers, presenters, and creators of this podcast are not liable for any actions or decisions taken by individuals based on the information presented herein. Always consult with a qualified healthcare provider for medical advice and treatment.